This CLE is based on appellate decisions released in September 2019 dealing with issues related to criminal law. The summaries of these decisions were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in September 2019, and they have been collected into a pamphlet, the September 2019 Criminal Law Update Pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to the pages in that pamphlet. The first case is People v. Roldan, R-O-L-L-D-A-N. It deals with two substantial issues, accessorial liability and constructive possession. Fourth Department affirmed defendant's kidnapping conviction, but reversed the weapons-related counts because the evidence she constructively possessed a weapon found in the house was legally insufficient. The court wrote, "We conclude that there is a valid line of reasoning and permissible inferences to support the conclusion that defendant had a shared intent or community of purpose with the principals. Defendant was present in a house when the police raided it and rescued two victims who were being held captive there, and the identification of one of the victims was found in a backpack the defendant was wearing when the police entered the house." Now, with respect to the constructive possession issue, the court wrote, "The weapons-related counts were based on her possession of a rifle that was found in the house after the police entered. To establish constructive possession of the weapon, the people had to establish that defendant exercised dominion or control over the weapon by a sufficient level of control over the area in which it was found. Here, the evidence established that prior to the arrival of the police, defendant was sitting in the living room of the house. The rifle was on a table in the living room, and one of the other perpetrators in the kidnapping put on a mask, grabbed the rifle, went to the room where the victims were being held, then came back to the living room and put the rifle back on the table. Contrary to the people's contention, that evidence is insufficient to establish that defendant had constructive possession of the weapon. A defendant's mere presence in the house where the weapon is found is insufficient to establish constructive possession, and there was no evidence establishing that defendant exercised dominion or control over the weapon." Next is People v. Overbaugh on page 5. It deals with an appellate issue. It was an appeal by the people. It was dismissed because the court found that there was no statutory authorization for the appeal from the particular motion that was brought. Third Department held the people's appeal from dismissal of the indictment and the denial of their motion for reconsideration, which was not authorized by statute, must be dismissed. County court had determined the victim's testimony at the grand jury was unsworn and could not be considered. The people then made a motion for reconsideration with proof the victim had been properly sworn. The court said, "It is well settled that no appeal lies from a determination made in a criminal action unless specifically provided for by statute. Here, the people's underlying motion purports to be one for reconsideration. However, even construing such motion as a motion to re-argue and or renew, there is no statute authorizing the people to appeal from the denial of such a motion in a criminal action." Next is People v. Harris. It's on page 6. It's another appeals issue case. Second Department held defendant's waiver of appeal was invalid. He therefore could challenge the denial of his suppression motion. However, Supreme Court did not make the statutorily required findings of fact and conclusions of law, so the matter was remitted for findings on all the issues raised by the suppression motion, and the appeal was held in abeyance. But with respect to the validity of the waiver of the right to appeal, the court said, when the Supreme Court attempted to explain to the defendant the waiver of the right to appeal, it improperly conflated the right to appeal with rights automatically forfeited by a plea of guilty. As such, the record does not demonstrate the defendant understood the nature of the right he was being asked to waive, or the distinction between the right to appeal and the other rights which are forfeited incident to a plea of guilty. Moreover, although the record of the proceedings reflects that the defendant executed a written waiver of his right to appeal, the court did not ascertain on the record whether the defendant had read the waiver or discussed it with defense counsel. Next is People v. Youngs. It's on page 7 and 8. It's a good discussion of how character evidence should be analyzed by the court. Essentially, the issue of the reliability of the evidence is a question of law for the judge, and the credibility of the character evidence is an issue for the jury. The Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction of predatory sexual assault against a child, criminal sexual act in the first degree, and endangering the welfare of a child, held defendant should have been allowed to present evidence of the child victim's reputation for untruthfulness. The court noted the two-pronged analysis for such character evidence: one, the reliability of the evidence, a question of law, and two, the credibility of the evidence, a question of fact. The court said, once the party seeking admission of reputation evidence has laid the proper foundation, it is for the jury to evaluate the credibility of the character witnesses who testify and to decide how much weight to give the views reported in their testimony. While a reasonable assurance of reliability is necessary for a proper foundation, such reasonable assurance exists where the testifying witnesses report the views of a sufficient number of people, and those views are based on sufficient experience with the person whose character is in question. Reputation evidence may be reliable, but still questionable from a credibility standpoint. This possibility, however, is not a proper basis for exclusion of reputation evidence. Reliability, whether a character witness has established a proper basis for knowing a key opposing witness's general reputation for truth and veracity, is a question of law for the court. By contrast, the credibility of such character witness, whether that witness is worthy or unworthy of belief or is motivated by bias, is a factual question for the jury. We caution that a trial court should not use reliability as a ground for excluding evidence it believes is not credible. Defendant proffered a proposed witness who was prepared to testify that she had known the victim since birth, that they were members of the same large extended family, and that many members of the extended family knew the victim. Further, the proposed witness was prepared to testify that she was aware of the victim's bad reputation for truthfulness among the extended family. County court erred when it determined that the proposed testimony failed to establish a proper foundation for admission of testimony regarding the victim's bad reputation for truthfulness. In fact, the offer of proof contained each element required by the leading case, People v. Fernandez, which is at 17 New York 3rd, at pages 76 and 77. Next is People v. Wilson on page 9. It deals with two separate issues, whether rape third is an inclusory concurrent count of rape first. The court found that it was not, but there was very little discussion of that issue. And the other issue involved an impermissible annotation on the verdict sheet. With respect to the verdict sheet, the court wrote, the verdict sheet, which states in relevant part, quote, fourth count, colon, rape in the third degree, parenthesis, lack of consent slash totality of circumstances, close parenthesis, end quote, contains an impermissible annotation. Specifically, the, quote, totality of circumstances, end quote, language is impermissible because it is not statutory language, referring to Criminal Procedure Law, Section 310.20, Subdivision 2, Penal Law, Section 130.25, Subsection 3. Rather, it is language from the pattern jury instructions. It cites the criminal jury instructions, Penal Law 130.25, Subdivision 3. Supreme Court was therefore required to obtain defense counsel's consent prior to submitting the annotated verdict sheet to the jury. Although consent to the submission of an annotated verdict sheet may be implied where defense counsel fails to object to the verdict sheet after having an opportunity to review it, here the record does not reflect whether defense counsel had that opportunity. We therefore hold the case, reserve decision, and remit the matter to Supreme Court to determine, following a hearing if necessary, whether defense counsel consented to the annotated verdict sheet. So the takeaway there is a verdict sheet which includes language or an annotation which is not in the part of the statutory language, the defense counsel must consent to the inclusion of that language on the verdict sheet. Next is People versus Copeland on page 10. This has to do with the judge's handling of jury notes. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the jury notes should have been read verbatim to counsel, not paraphrased. The court said, the record reveals that the Supreme Court did not read the entire contents of the two jury notes into the record, and there was no indication that the entire contents of the notes otherwise were shared with counsel. Rather, the court improperly paraphrased the notes. Counsel's awareness of the existence of a note does not effectuate the court's proper discharge of its statutory duty. Although defense counsel may have been made aware of the existence and gist of the second note during an off-the-record discussion, this is insufficient to establish that counsel had been made aware of the precise contents of the note. Where a trial transcript does not show compliance with Orama's procedure, it cannot be assumed that the omission was remedied at an off-the-record conference to which the transcript does not refer. As such, Supreme Court committed a mode of proceedings error when it failed to provide counsel with meaningful notice of the precise contents of substantive jury inquiries, and therefore reversal is required. Next is People versus Price on page 11. It has to do with the timing of a peremptory challenge. The Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the denial of defense counsel's slightly late peremptory challenge to an unsworn juror was an abuse of discretion. The court wrote, the court named prospective juror number one to be signed a seat. When defense counsel interrupted, stating that he had made an error and he had intended to exercise a peremptory challenge to prospective juror number one. Defense counsel acknowledged that the challenge was a couple of seconds late and requested permission to excuse prospective juror number one. The court summarily denied the request. Where a belated peremptory challenge to as yet unsworn prospective jurors would interfere with or delay the process of jury selection, it is a proper exercise of the court's discretion to refuse to permit the challenge. However, where there is no discernible interference or undue delay caused by defense counsel's momentary oversight that would justify the court's hasty refusal to entertain the defendant's challenge, it is an improvident exercise of discretion to deny it. Next is Matter of P on pages 12 and 13. It's a juvenile delinquency case, and it lays out the procedure for a plea allocution in family court. Second Department, reversing family court in this juvenile delinquency proceeding, determined the court failed to comply with the notice provisions and the plea allocution requirements of the Family Court Act. as well as the proof requirements of the penal law. It was alleged the appellant either recklessly or intentionally broke a window. The court wrote, although the family court advised the appellant of her rights prior to accepting an admission, the court failed to obtain an allocution from a parent or a person legally responsible for the appellant with regard to their understanding of any rights the appellant may be waiving as a result of her admission. And it cites Family Court Act, Section 321.3, Subdivision 1. The appellant appeared telephonically, even though there is no provision under Article 3 of the Family Court Act authorizing the appearance by telephone of a minor in a juvenile delinquency proceeding. And the only persons in court that day were the appellant's attorney and the attorney representing the Ulster County Attorney's Office. Since the provisions of Family Court Act Section 321.3 may not be waived, and the record does not support the determination of the court that a reasonable and substantial effort was made to notify the appellant's mother or guardian about the proceeding, the fact-finding order must be vacated. Next is People v. Garcia on page 13. It's a search and seizure case. Second Department, on an appeal by the people, held that finding a small amount of cocaine on defendant driver's person did not provide probable cause to believe drugs would be in the trunk of the vehicle. Therefore, the weapon and drugs found in the trunk, as well as defendant's statements about searching the trunk, were properly suppressed. The court wrote, contrary to the people's contention, cases in which there is circumstantial evidence of recent drug use within the passenger compartment, such as when the police during a routine traffic stop detect the odor of burning marijuana, are distinguishable, since such evidence provides good reason to believe that the unseen drugs may be located somewhere within the vehicle. By contrast, the fact that a small quantity of drugs is found on the defendant's person, with no other drugs being found in the passenger compartment of the vehicle, does not, without more, provide probable cause to believe additional drugs may be found in the trunk of the vehicle. Next, on page 14, People v. Pastore. It's another search and seizure case. Fourth Department held defendant's motion to suppress a handgun found in his vehicle and a post-seizure statement was properly granted. The court said, officers responded to the complainant's home after receiving a call that he had been threatened by defendant. The complainant told an officer that defendant threatened to shoot him and that he believed the threat was serious because defendant had been in possession of a black handgun prior to the incident. Defendant, who was seated in his truck, which was parked in front of the complainant's home, acknowledged that he had previously said he would shoot the complainant if the complainant entered defendant's property. Based on that information and defendant's admissions that he owned a rifle, which was at his home, and that he had a Virginia pistol permit but no New York pistol permit, the officers searched defendant's person but recovered no weapons. The officers then searched the area near the driver's seat of defendant's truck, from which they recovered a loaded handgun. The automobile exception to the warrant requirement permits a police officer to search a vehicle without a warrant when the officer has probable cause to believe that evidence or contraband will be found. The police did not have probable cause to search defendant's vehicle after they searched him and determined that there was no immediate threat to their safety. Inasmuch as defendant was not alleged to have brandished a gun at the scene, there was inconclusive evidence that he actually threatened the complainant at the scene. Defendant did not engage in any suspicious or furtive movements, and the officers did not observe any weapons or related contraband in the vehicle or on defendant's person. The officer's search of defendant's vehicle was not justifiable as a limited safety search. Probable cause is not required for a limited search of a vehicle where, following a lawful stop, facts revealed during a proper inquiry or other information gathered during the course of the encounter lead to the conclusion that a weapon located within the vehicle presents an actual and specific danger to the officer's safety sufficient to justify a further intrusion. The Court of Appeals has emphasized that a reasonable suspicion alone will not suffice, and that the likelihood of a weapon in the vehicle must be substantial, and the danger to the officer's safety actual and specific. Next is People v. Snyder on page 15. It's a Sex Offender Registration Act case where the court found that a downward departure from level 2 to level 1 was appropriate. Second Department, lowering defendant's risk assessment from a level 2 to a level 1, held that defendant was herself a victim of sex trafficking and her participation in the conspiracy occurred at the same time that she was being exploited. The court said, the circumstances identified and proven by the defendant are not accounted for by the SORA guidelines and tend to demonstrate a lower likelihood of reoffense and danger to the community. The defendant's evidence showed that she was exploited by the commercial sex industry when she was a minor, and that while she later took on some management responsibilities by training other girls, answering phones, and making appointments, at the same time she continued to be exploited by that industry as she was simultaneously served as a sex worker. There was no evidence or indication that the defendant recruited the identified victim or any victims, or that she engaged in any acts or conduct to coerce the victim or any victims to engage in prostitution. Indeed, the defendant's level of responsibility in the sex trafficking conspiracy can be gauged by the federal sentencing court's decision to sentence the defendant to time served. Finally, under these circumstances, we find that a departure to a level 1 risk designation is warranted as a matter of discretion to avoid an overassessment of the defendant's dangerousness and risk of sexual recidivism. Next is People v. Roman on pages 16 and 17. It's a right to counsel case, suppression of statements. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction and ordering a new trial. Held defendant had requested an attorney in Nevada, and upon being returned to New York, was questioned without waiving his right to counsel in the presence of counsel. Therefore, the statements should have been suppressed. The court said, defendant's motion to suppress his incriminating written and videotaped statements should have been granted. Several days before defendant made the contested statements, he was taken into custody by the Las Vegas Police Department. While in custody, defendant requested to speak with the detective from the Regional Fugitive Task Force who had located defendant in Las Vegas and was about to bring him back to New York. The detective met defendant in a conference room and asked him if he wanted to talk. Defendant said, I would like to tell you what happened, but I think I want to talk to an attorney. The detective, who responded by saying okay and did not ask defendant any questions about the homicide, testified that he understood that defendant wanted an attorney. Upon returning to New York, defendant met with the investigating detective and made incriminating written and video statements. Defendant moved to suppress his statements, which was denied, and the statements were admitted at trial. When a defendant in custody unequivocally requests the assistance of counsel, any purported waiver of that right obtained in the absence of counsel is ineffective. Next is People v. Ravenel on pages 17 and 18. It's a street stop case. Second Department held the defendant did not have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity at the time defendant fled and the police pursued him. The police responded to reports of gunshots heard in the vicinity. A witness reported hearing a gunshot and seeing two men walking, one wearing dark clothes and the other wearing a white jacket. The defendant and another man matched that description. When the police approached the defendant, he ran. The defendant was arrested after a pursuit and a gun was found nearby. Defendant was charged with criminal possession of a weapon. The motion court suppressed the gun. The court wrote, here the police lacked reasonable suspicion that the defendant had committed, was committing, or was about to commit a crime, the necessary predicate for pursuit. Although clothing worn by the defendant and his companion matched the clothing described by the unidentified witness, the witness never saw either of the two men fire or possess a gun. There's no evidence in the record that the police saw any weapons or a bulge or outline of a weapon on the defendant, which could indicate that he was involved in a crime. Furthermore, contrary to the people's contention, the manner in which the defendant held his hands while he ran did not give the police reasonable suspicion to pursue. A stop must be justified in its inception. And at the time that the police began to chase the defendant, he had both hands in his jacket pocket, an innocuous placement that is susceptible of an innocent as well as a culpable interpretation. At this point, I will insert the verification code for the attorney affirmation. The verification code for this September 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE is culpable. Again, the verification code for your attorney affirmation for the 2019 Criminal Law Update pamphlet for September is culpable. The final case in this CLE is People v. Monfort on pages 18 and 19. It deals with when a charge can be made by a superior court information. It's a Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals, reversing defendant's conviction by guilty plea, held that the New York State Constitution and Criminal Procedure Law Section 195.10, Subdivision 1, prohibited defendant's waiver of indictment because defendant was charged with an A felony with a potential life sentence. The defendant was charged with second-degree murder, waived indictment, and pled to a superior court information charging first-degree manslaughter. The court noted that this jurisdictional issue could be considered on appeal despite the guilty plea and the failure to raise the issue below. The court said, the New York State Constitution provides that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on indictment of a grand jury. That's Article 1, Section 6. The Constitution contains a limited exception to this jurisdictional requirement. Quote, a person held for the action of a grand jury upon a charge for such an offense, other than one punishable by death or life imprisonment, with the consent of the district attorney, may waive indictment by a grand jury and can consent to be prosecuted on an information filed by the district attorney. In addition, Criminal Procedure Law Section 195.10 provides that a defendant may waive indictment by grand jury when, among other conditions, the defendant is not charged with a Class A felony punishable by death or life imprisonment. Accordingly, under both the Constitution and criminal procedure law, a defendant who was held for the action of the grand jury on a Class A felony punishable by life imprisonment may not waive indictment by the grand jury and agree to be prosecuted for a lesser included offense in order to facilitate a plea bargain on the homicide offense. That concludes this September 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE.